From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. From time to time, everyone pauses to think, where are we going? Some of us try to predict, and others of us actually lead us there. One of those people is Kevin Kelly. He's the executive editor of Wired Magazine. We'll talk to him about society today and about his new book, Out of Control, The Rise of Neobiological Civilization. We'll also talk with Doug Engelbart, best known as the creator of the mouse, that little electronic gadget that lets us move the pointer around our computer screens. We'll talk with him about the mouse and about the new information world in which we will live. Kevin Kelly is the executive editor of Wired Magazine, the cutting-edge technology monthly. Another cutting-edge personality, Howard Rheingold, calls Kevin a trend anticipator. I asked Kevin what he thought that meant.
A trend anticipator is somebody who is probably spending a little bit too much time looking into the future, trying to spot what the patterns are that may only seem sort of embryonic and hints, and that will later develop into things that will affect a lot of people. The kind of trends that I like to look at, truthfully, dwell around technology. I think technology is a huge shaper of our culture right now. And technology, I define fairly broadly, from hardware stuff to things like writing. Writing is a technology. So it can be very broad and really does have an impact on our society. The kind of trends that I have been spending some time with recently are trends that have a lot to do with how people understand very complicated things, because the society that we're making is becoming more complicated. And so there are some things happening out there. They're in research labs. They're in companies who are trying to manufacture products. There are philosophical trends, philosophical musings that are all sort of come together and form a larger picture, which to me says that in 25 years or so, our world will be a little different, and I think I have a glimmer of what that might be.
When people talk about the new technology coming down and the new changes, you were saying there's great excitement, and the predictions, they go faster and faster, and they're always saying accelerate, 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 and just get ready for it. But my experience of the universe is that, yes, there are periods when there's great acceleration, and then there's a slowdown, a yin and a yang. Where do you think we are? I mean, are we just on the start of a major acceleration period, or are we coming over the top here?
I think you're right that there are these periods of quickening and sort of quieting in evolutionary biology and the evolution of life on Earth. This theory that life evolves faster sometimes than others is called punctuated equilibrium, meaning that there are periods when things don't change very much and that stasis is actually the norm. I would not be surprised when we have a longer history of technology that we see that happening in technology, that there are ups and downs in terms of the rate of change. I think what we're seeing right now is that we're just sort of at the beginning of a very rapid rise of a quickening, of an increase in acceleration of change, and that change is primarily going to be due to communications technology. I think computer technology, as machines that calculated, that, you know, that added up numbers or did spreadsheets or replaced slide rules, was very important and very helpful. But the real revolution that we're anticipating will come from this communication revolution, which has not really even begun yet, both technically as well as socially.
What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think the general central act of the next century is connecting everything to everything. And by everything, I mean everything. Every human-made thing, from a book to a doorway to a window to a chair to cars to appliances to pieces of paper will communicate in some fashion with each other and with us. And that communication will happen at the level of just letting you know that, finding out where they are, location, to communicating whether they have something written on them and what it is, to interacting with the environment. We can think of simple examples right now, like a thermostat, which we know hardly 5 years ago, you'd move by hand to kind of set it where you want, and now they have programmable thermostats, and the next step is to have thermostats that know what time it is and that respond to the outside weather or how many people are in the house. We can imagine a world where when someone rings your doorbell, it turns your stereo down so you can hear it. Your refrigerator knows whether it orders milk before the milk container is empty. Goods and packages on the shelf of the grocery store know how much they cost, and how much they cost depends on how much people are buying it. The price of lettuce would change by demand. This is some hint of the kind of ecological grouping of different bits of machines and matter and stuff that we make is all going to communicate with each other. And the effect of that will be very profound.
My guest today is Kevin Kelly, formerly the publisher and editor of the Whole Earth Review. His new book is called Out of Control, The Rise of Neobiological Civilization. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Let's talk about this concept of biology and how it operates versus how we think things have operated. We grew up with that. Tell us about that.
Well, there, from the very beginning, when humans began to make technology, we've made it in a way that was most useful to us, which was trying to, as devices of control, to try and extract power from it. And in the very beginning, technology has obeyed what we would call linear rules. And a linear rule would be if I make a little change in the system will have a predictable...
scientific method.
Right.
Very linear.
Right. A small or predictable outcome. So we have levers and gears and clocks and... sometimes they get very complicated, so we would have a car, but basically you press on the gas pedal of the car a little bit and it goes a little bit faster. You press on it a lot and it goes a lot faster. That's a sort of a linear model. But it's also evident when we look at biology and organisms that, you know, creatures don't work that way. You could poke an animal a little bit, and it might scream and hop around and jump over a fence, and you could push it a lot, and it might not do anything. So there's no correlation between small amounts of disturbance and great amounts of change. And that's one example in which biology is sort of different from machines. The problem is that as we made machines more and more complicated, right now we're talking about factories, a paper factory, a paper mill, or a nuclear power plant. The complexity in that is just staggering. It really is truly beyond one person or even a group of people's conception. And this is why we have sort of these weird accidents, because nobody can really put that all in their mind. And we're headed toward a place where we make things even more complicated. Space stations. I was just at Microsoft yesterday, and their latest piece of software is 4 million lines of code, and they were talking about doubling or quadrupling that in a couple of years. So we're talking, 8 million, 16 million lines of code. How does anybody even comprehend that or engineer it? The answer is that no humans can engineer it. We cannot control, we cannot anticipate what happens in 10 million lines of code or a billion lines of code in a software program. So if we're going to make things more complicated, how can we do it? The answer is that we can do it by imitating the principles of biology, because biology, the nature, if we look at the tundras, the rainforest, the meadows, the complexity there is far beyond what we've made in our machines, and yet it's all managed and it works well. And so the question is, how does nature do it?
Where else do we see this now besides organizations? Do we see it in what we're building itself?
Yes, as we, it's even closer than that. It's right behind your eyes. The current understanding of how our brains work is that when scientists look inside the mind or the brain, they find that nobody's home. There's nobody. There's
nobody. Feels that way today.
There's nobody in charge. This is it's the same model as the internet model. People complain about certain happenings on the internet. There's advertising, there's flames, there's this and that. Somebody should stop it. Well, there's nobody in charge, so it's very hard to stop. There are ways, and these are, again, the laws that I've extracted of how do you have some control in these uncontrollable, anarchical, decentralized, distributed systems. The beehive that I like to use, I'm a beekeeper, I keep bees, and one of the common misperceptions is that the queen bee is in charge. Well, the queen bee is just an egg factory. She lays eggs. She's appointed, chosen by the hive as a whole, and does not lead the hive. She actually follows the swarm when they exit. So who's in charge of the hive? Who decides which queen bee to select? And the answer is that the hive decides. It's sort of an emergent phenomena in the language of the scientists studying complexity. They call these things emergent. It's a sort of the sum of the parts, which is much greater than the individual parts. And we are seeing people manufacture things in the same way. Besides the internet, there are attempts to try and use that kind of a logic to build very complex things like a system that has no garbage or pollutants in a I would call it kind of a regional wide ecologically sound manufacturing system. Another example of this sort of headless kind of community is the whole idea of a democracy. I mean, when the Tories were first confronted with this idea that we were going to make a country that was a democracy, they were, in retrospect, legitimately concerned about it, because how, you know, without a kind of a authoritarian top-down ruling, you would just have a mob.
Who is in charge?
Who is in charge? Right, you're going to let all these people decide what where the country's going to go, and that concern about mobness is still a legitimate concern, and we see that happening in places like the internet, where people kind of do their own thing to a great extent. But there are advantages to letting the mob steer. And the main advantage and the main reason why I think we're going to see more of this kind of decentralized control is the fact that it's very flexible. We're in an environment right now where everything is changing very, very quickly. The technical environment's changing, the social environment's changing very fast, and a command-style economy, a command-style corporation, a command-style technology cannot anticipate 5 years down the road. It can't even anticipate 6 months. And so you have to have something that's very flexible and very adaptable. And almost in every case, when we look at what that structure looks like, it's a very distributed, decentralized network.
The internet was originally designed by the Department of Defense to be a network that would never go down. That, in fact, the closer the architecture gets to biology, the more robust it is.
Exactly.
And so that would be true of any system, human or otherwise, that we design.
Exactly. And if we look at biological systems, again, if we go back to biology for the inspiration about how we make our technology, we find some very interesting things. We find that it's very redundant. We find that it's actually very, what we would consider, inelegant, in the sense that it's clumsy, it goes a long way around. It does things that maybe not in the simplest way, but it works. Whenever we evolve things, both in biology and artificially within computers, we find the same kinds of results where the thing works, we have no idea how it works, and we look at the code and we say, that's garbage. I mean, that's not very elegant, it's not very smooth. And the lesson is that's what you want. You want something that's sort of overbuilt. It's kludgy and jury-rigged, but it works.
That does kind of confuse me a little bit. There's something sort of half-formed in my brain that say when I look at beehives, well, they don't just march along. There is a dance to how they work, so that it's almost like you can't just stick things on. Because actually, the laws of nature will have them fall off.
Well, no, in fact, you can't stick them all. But one of the principles that I talk about in my book, I list these as the 9 laws of God, and I speak of God in this case with a small g. This is these are principles that anybody who's trying to construct something very complicated that can be on a self-sustaining path, that can repair itself, that has some degree of autonomy, would use in creating that. That would, whether that's a simulation game, whether that's a virtual reality world, whether that's attempt at artificial life or artificial intelligence, whether that's a sort of a self-ongoing space station, these laws apply and would be helpful to anybody trying to create them. And one of the first, I'm not sure it's the first law in my list, but one of the most important laws is that to build anything complex, you have to build it from a simple thing that works. You cannot just ex nihilo, just from nothing, create something very complex all in one stroke. You actually have to, you can think of it as growing it. You have to make something very, very simple that works, and it's not doing what you want the whole thing to do, but it's a part that works as a whole. It's like if you were going to make a brain, you want to at least make a working neuron, and then you have that neuron make a reflex like blinking. So you can get blinking down. If you can get blinking down, then you might try some kind of a fear module working, and you can build up something very complex by adding these little parts, each of which would work on its own. And that architecture is now being used to build robots and cartoon characters and things like that.
It's called bottom-up software programming.
That's right. And it works. And this is how nature works. Nature evolved. I mean, they got a cell. You got a cell working. And the interesting thing is, if you look at our cells now in our human body, they're not that much different from a algae cell that might have been present on Earth, you know, millions of years ago. So the idea was, you got the cell working, you don't fool around with the cell very much. You just build on top of the cell. And so systems that we appreciate as being self-sustaining, if we look at them, we will see that they are built up from parts that we could deconstruct into self-sustainable little modules. Right now, they're making software in the same way. It's called object-oriented programming, which is a lot of fancy words. The main thing you want to remember about it is that it's modular software. The modules work. You can kind of like tinker toys, put them all together, build something. And individually, that's how you make something very complex work.
And individually, they are no bigger than a human can really get a hit on.
That's right.
And really understand.
That's right.
And understanding our own limitations helps us learn how to build in that regard.
That's right.
Let's talk about some other rules of God's. Tell us, what's your next favorite rule? See, I knew it didn't have to be number one because you're not linear anymore, Kevin.
<That's right>.
So it doesn't matter what order they come in.
One that may be difficult to explain very quickly is a very important one, and that is that when you're creating something, you should seek persistent disequilibrium. And what that means is that the most interesting things happen in the kind of cusp, the edge between a complete uncontrolled chaos, loosey-goosey, disjointed, random, anything goes, space. And something that's very orderly, very predictable, very controlled, very contained. An example would be You know, your hand, if your hand was bound up in a tight fist, it's not very useful. If it was just sort of wet jelly, it's not useful either. But your hand has a, you know, it's most interesting and most useful when it's neither still nor completely hyperactive. It's somewhere in that between state. So when we build things, we want them sort of to be on the edge and constantly teetering and almost falling over. And that state of almost falling over, but staying poised constantly on the edge, is actually the edge where life dwells. If we look at all the internal workings of life, from a DNA molecule, which is the kind of blueprint genetic code, to any of the parts of the cell, we find that they are sort of, by any reason, they should just be collapsing. Because they're sort of tilted too far. They're almost going to fall apart. The pieces of them, the glue, the bonds, the kind of chemical bonds that are holding them together, or if you just flick it in the right with your pinky, the thing will just fall apart. It's just so balanced on the edge of falling apart. And that's actually where the most useful states of building something come. So the lesson would be, if you're making a company or something, you want to err on the side of not being overly controlled and rigid and having everything in order. You don't want to be a complete chaotic mess, but you want something that sort of favors and is really on the brink of almost unraveling.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Kevin Kelly. He's the executive editor of Wired Magazine, and his new book is called Out of Control, The Rise of Neobiological Civilization. We know you are executive editor of Wired, and as well as formerly you were the publisher and editor of the Whole Earth Review. With this sort of interesting approach, what was your experience before then? What did you do before then?
I've always been a science groupie. In high school, I took all the advanced calculus, chemistry, biology, of course, courses I could get my hands on. In fact, I went to I went to a high school that graduated some 93% of its students to college, and I took every science course and a math course that they had to offer. I still might be the only one to have done that, but I didn't go into college. I spent my college years traveling in Asia as a photographer, getting sort of graduate degrees in, Asian cultures, traveling the old ways, history, things like that, as well as photography. I began writing by writing captions for photographs, and it kept getting longer. I
wouldn't fit on the back of the picture.
That's right. And I got into computers and technology of this current modern stripe by starting a mail order business. I needed to have a computer to do the mailing labels, the database. Got an Apple II, and very soon after getting Apple II to do this, I plugged the Apple II into the phone jack and had a religious experience. even back in 1981 or so, there was this something happening, and I saw that computers were much more valuable as communication devices than as calculating devices. In fact, I think we should call them connectors instead of computers. And that was the beginning of my interest in them. And I'm not a nerd. I'm not a person. I'm a person who still needs help changing my software. I grab wizards who know how to do these things, and I say, do that and don't tell me how you do it because I don't want to know. I'm a person, I use a Macintosh, and my rule of thumb for software is, if I have to read a manual, I don't want to use the software, and I still operate that way.
I have to say that I had sort of a hidden agenda asking you that. The thinking in your book was so original to me. I thought to myself, well, where the heck was this guy? And it turns out I was there slaving over my books, and you were traveling around Asia.
Okay. So. Yeah, there is a... I'm I work with some futurists who are involved with a device of looking to the future called scenarios. And the idea of a scenario is that you can't predict the future. All you can do is anticipate some of the boundaries or some of the limits in which it might happen in. And the idea is that if you can at least think about some of the alternatives that might happen, you could be prepared for them when they begin to happen, if you could recognize it. And one of the interesting skills about doing scenarios is that you want to think the unthinkable. You want to be outside of the mindset in which everybody is in. So everybody right now, so we do a common exercise of what are the unthinkables right now? What are the things that everybody assumes will be true that possibly might not be true, and how would that affect things? And so if you think about it, if you take yourself out, if you pretend you're a Martian or somebody from Nepal, who is just meeting this for the first time, it's a little bit easier to ask yourself, what are the things everybody assumes, and is there something that we can do with that outside the usual parameters? And because that's usually where things happen. I mean, if you William Gibson, a science fiction writer, a lot of science fiction writers are very good at this, and that's what makes them so special, was sort of remarking about someone from the, like, say, 70s looking at even the 90s and all the surprises that would have come along that you would not have expected if you told someone in the 70s, sexual revolution, yeah, it didn't happen. You know, you get the thing called AIDS, you know, great plagues.
Oh, right, plagues.
Yeah, right. You know, the moon, we've never gone back.
Yeah, 25 years.
Years, right. So there's a lot of the things that come along are very surprising because people just aren't thinking wide enough. And I think that that happens a lot in science. In fact, one of the, I might fool myself, but I think there is a certain extent that's true, that science writers actually are having an increasing role in science itself for several reasons. One is because the specialties that scientists get involved in don't allow them to go outside their field very wide, and the field is getting wider day by day, so they rely on non-expert generalists like myself to kind of fill them in on other specialties in science. And the second thing is that a lot of science is extracting, synthesizing, making analysis, and that's what someone like myself as a writer can do. We have some of that freedom of taking chances, of stepping back, of not having to be absolutely right, and having the time to try and synthesize a field that may be very fast moving. And so I think there is a role for amateurs like myself, and I'm a science groupie and I'm just looking at this, but I think it can be helpful to other people who may even be involved in the actual research that I'm reporting on.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
My guest today has been Kevin Kelly, the executive editor of Wired Magazine. His new book is called Out of Control, The Rise of Neobiological Civilization, published by Addison Wesley. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. For decades, Doug Engelbart has made significant contributions to information technology. You may not be familiar with the name Doug Engelbart, but if you've used a personal computer, you're definitely familiar with a mouse. Since Doug invented the mouse, I asked him how the mouse came into being.
Actually, we built the first mouse 20 years ago, and we built it for supporting the interactive use with displays. And it took at least 10 before the rest of the world got interested. No, wait a minute. It was 30 years ago. Excuse me.
Time flies.
Yes, 30 years ago. And it took almost 20 years before the personal computer began to come up enough. So then somebody started using the mice with them and like that. But it's hard to explain why it took that long.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we can put our finger on the mouse. I mean, that's pretty clear. But there were other innovations that went on during that period. What were they?
Well, I think we were doing the very first of doing your editing on a full screen where, you know, if you were changing a word, the word just changed in place rather than a new line was printed or something of that sort. And the first to do multiple windows, and the first to do outline processing, because that was part of our files, the first to do hyperstructure, hypertext, the first to do shared screen conferencing at a distance, the first to build a sort of front-end, back-end, that's sort of like the client-server relationship is today, that's the way it was working. This binary key set that you use with one hand to input characters with chord strokes.
With the chord board.
Yes, that it made it so that while the cursor was in transit up to some object on the screen that you wanted to do something to, so your right hand would be moving the cursor with the mouse and your left hand could be saying what you want to do. So that by the time you clicked on it, you were done prescribing what you wanted. And so that was much faster than the subsequent thing of clicking on something and then telling it what to do, either by a menu or command button keys. So this doing them in parallel just went much faster. So there were...
We haven't quite caught up with that one, though.
No, somehow that one people resist, but it's still... this is part of what we've been assuming all this time, is that there'll come a time when the performance level at doing knowledge work will become something that it's itself is an objective. And it's not just that, oh, look, now I can automate what I used to do. It's that, wow, I've got these processes and tasks that may be different from what I used to do because I have these new tools, but look at the capability and power I've got. And to go after that power, particularly collective power and in groups and communities, to have much more effectiveness at developing and integrating and applying their knowledge. So that's been the driving force all the time. So if you think about that a while, you realize that you never hear about any measures of power or capability or effectiveness for the humans, which is the objective. So we said, all right, let's go after high performance. Have that as a first objective. And then we say, when we learn how much performance value can get, then let's start looking at how easy you can make it to learn or to use, and at different grades of that easiness, trade it off to say, well, it's going to cost you this much to learn, but look at the power you get. And that instead of having some arbitrary thing people somehow set, mostly marketeers, of saying, oh, my system's very easy to learn and natural to use.
And independent of whatever may
yes,
be so.
And so that... if people come along with something that is different from that, then you're not modern, unquote, unquote. But if you can fly twice as fast as they can, it's very hard to get them to sit down and show, because that isn't a factor in today's considerations.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Doug Engelbart, creator of the mouse and many other technical innovations. Currently, Dr. Engelbart is director of the Bootstrap Institute. We've talked about things like Windows, and the patent you got on the mouse was it 1964. Well, I guess you must be rich.
No.
Well, why not?
Well, somehow, maybe I wasn't smart enough. No, anyway, I somehow got wedded to an objective career-wise that I really wanted to try to make the most difference in how humans could cope with complexity and urgency. And I got committed to this before I even understood the potential for earning money, personally.
So you weren't really looking at products, per se. You were looking at a much different vision.
Yeah, it's like someone goes out and explores a new territory to see. It feels like there's a lot of wealth out there if people move out there. But if you're motivated to do the exploring and unfold it and have the image of seeing a society that can move out there, there aren't a lot of ways while you're doing exploring to stake out. And and if you're going to stop and really commercialize or capitalize on some things, your commitment to making a profit has to supersede every other basic commitment. And so for me, it was exploring and trying to get the world to see what was there. And people have told me that, well, the market's going to take care of getting us out there. And I know the market has a process for evolving its products and all. But what I see is that when the world is changing as rapidly as it is now, that the people who are buying what the vendors are selling haven't any great picture of what's in the future. You know, if the increment of change is beyond what's easy to picture when you're doing your work and you say, oh, if I had something to help me do this, and I'd buy it. So that slow organic evolution was all right when the rate of change and improvement in the technology, for instance, was below a certain value, then okay. But now the rate is so high that the other boundary of our frontier out there is sort of almost out of sight from how we know how to integrate all these things. And so that we just really have to find a way to explore that frontier, set up working outposts out there, and shake them down so we have a real map for how our organizations are going to move.
Where did you start? How did you start this process? When did you realize you were looking at this? What were you looking at?
Oh, well, it's funny. That's almost embarrassing because the way I handled the questions that came up to my mind were, you know, mature in one way, but immature in another. See, I was 25 and had just gotten engaged. This is a funny
story. This is a very romantic story. I like this.
Oh, yeah, it's very romantic. So you can blame...
My one vice as an engineer, all right?
Yeah, you can blame my current wife for all my problems here. I'd grown up in the Depression time when times were really rough, and for some reason the kind of limits on one's goals were sort of like getting a steady job and then getting married and living happily ever after. So, you know, it was very simple, basic goals. But so here I had a steady job. I was working for the NACA as an electrical engineer. That's the forerunner of NASA down at Ames Laboratory in Mountain View, you know, helping manage wind tunnel power systems and so on. But going to work the next Monday, I was all excited by all my new state of things, but thinking about work, and I had this image of a featureless hall stretching way out ahead of me with nice, pleasant sort of hall. It was nice people to work with and all, but there weren't any singular features out there. By the time I got there, I realized, you know, I don't have any professional goals beyond an interesting job. And this made me so chagrined. You know, I was old enough, mature enough to be embarrassed by that. So I thought, well, God, why don't I spend some time thinking about it? So for the next months, I'd spend my weekday evenings. My fiance lived so far away, we only saw each other on weekends. So I'd start really seriously looking at all the crusades I could join. What could I do? I could go back to school and become an economist or a teacher or something to make a real impact. What I finally picked out very soon was, what could I do for a career that would contribute the most to mankind? That was just an academic question I asked myself. And somehow that got welded into the analysis. It's almost embarrassing, you know. And about 3 months later, I'd gone to libraries, I'd looked up all kinds of crusades, I'd realized that, gee, if you drain all the swamps in a tropical area, yes, you'll maybe cure the malaria problem, but then people get carried away and they don't understand the environment, so they overpopulate and pretty soon there's bad off. And so you say, well, how do you design an end goal that, if achieved, won't have side effects that are as bad or worse than what you did have? And I said, God, it's just too complex. And then I got to thinking how hard it was to design and run a crusade compared to a company. Good grief, it's so complex. And it just dawned on me one Saturday morning, the complexity, that's a really basic problem. And not only that, the shorter and shorter time span in which our ever more complex problems can get solved means it's an urgency to them. And the product of increased complexity times increased urgency is a double factored increase in the difficulty of coping. So I just says, oh, Now, what if I could find some way that would boost humanity's capability collectively to handle complexity and urgency? So that was in 1951.
My guest today is Doug Engelbart, director of the Bootstrap Institute and well-known for his many contributions to information technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. In the 60s and the 70s, when you would speak to organizations about how wonderful it was for everyone to have their own personal computer, it wasn't particularly well received.
Right.
How was it received? What were the objections? And then when did you realize the tide had turned?
Well, let's see. The tide's only turned for part of the story. It's sort of like one leaf at a time turned. I can remember when I would tell people seriously that every knowledge worker is going to have a terminal on his desk and working that way. And, you know, at that time, it was just laughable in people's minds. So it's the kind of statement that you learn to make only in particular situations, because it'll turn people off on you. It's as though you'd become a political radical, and they will sort of want to avoid you because you embarrass them with your radicalness. But I'd known enough about the technology and done quite a big study on the dimensional scaling, that's reducing size of different kind of devices, including electronics, just to know that we'd be moving into domains where the size reduction would start being able to harness different kinds of phenomena from the one we were using at the time, and that really pursuing that, the limit on the speed and capacity for the digital circuitry was just way beyond anything that would take to make it practical to do what I was talking about, so I was confident. And I remember just a simple thing like the mouse, that I'd see editorials once in a while of somebody, sort of a columnist in a trade journal, said, well, I've tried it, and it's really too hard. It's an awkward, too hard thing to use. And so you just shrug your shoulders and know that somehow there's a way in which they were integrating that into their interaction that it didn't pay off like it did for us, but what can you say? And then when the personal computers came out, trying to tell some of the leaders in that field that you're going to want to connect them together, that was, say, 12 to 13 years after the ARPANET had gotten started, with a lot of experience about the high payoff of being connected. Oh, no. All they saw was that the previous mode had been a time-sharing system that was always overloaded and the response was so slow, and now you can just have your own computer. And it says, yeah, but sure, but if you're not connected together, it's like having a really nice office with no door. But you absolutely couldn't shake them. And so even IBM followed suit and came out with PCs that weren't interconnected or even connected into the mainframes. So, all right, personal computers came out with a lot of interactions that were kind of nice, but it took almost a decade before the flow of interest in the connecting. And so you say, what's the lost opportunity cost to our society that came because of that sort of blindness, that they couldn't, the world somehow didn't see that was inevitable?
Well, it seems like that's just turned around. It's like all of a sudden.
Well, those leaves have started to turn.
Okay. Now tell me about the other leaves. What other things can't the prevailing paradigm see today?
Well, there's a very simple one of, what's a document? See, he says, well, let's see, a document? Well, here's a document, here's this book or this notebook, or here's a two-page memorandum. Well, do you consider your email message as a document? Well, maybe. Well, all right, what do you think if people are going to be living more and more online? Then what's the function and form optimally there for a document? And it says, so this is what I went through in the early 60s, is saying there can be all kinds of revolution. Let's try to find some of the major dimensions or vectors of that change and get them started changing now, because starting a new vector is hard. So that's what led me into saying, all right, you're really, a document is a means for externalizing the symbols that stand for the concept structures you've got in your head. You externalize them, and that's in some form that's studyable and dealable and manipulable by other people and maybe yourself. And so, all right, when I externalize them in a computer, gee, I can use list structures and do all kinds of things for the way they're held in a computer. So I can make a map in the computer of the structure of symbols that more naturally maps the structure in my mind. Oh, that's great. But just think of all those pointers and everything. Oh, the computer can help me put it out there. Oh, that's right, interactive support for creating it. But just think of the complexity of looking at with all those things. No, wait, the computer can help you by giving you all sorts of optional views of that structure, including a view that looks like a page, if you wish. But to set it up so that the page is the model for how you're supposed to view it is just losing a whole bunch of the potential in the future. So we got this system going in the 60s and 70s. So, hey, you can jump to any object in that document. And when you're on the way in there, you have very flexible ways to specify the view. You know, outline views, all kinds of filtered views, all kinds of ways like that the computer can do for you. So when you go to what's held to be the epitome of today's system, load a document. I load it and scroll through the pages to where I want to go. And the comparison is just ludicrous about how quickly and flexibly you can really move around. But to people, a document is still held in their minds as that sort of paged, structured thing. And you say, God, that, you know, it's sort of like people who had paper and such were still using tablets as a model.
Yeah. The paper went away, tablets. But we didn't know that.
Anyway, that's the kind of a leaf that has to turn.
Well, now you've created the Bootstrap Institute. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's, well, 30 years ago, 33 years ago, I'd gotten enough support while at SRI to sit off by myself and kind of create what I needed to do, what I called the conceptual framework for augmenting the humans. See, that's where a lot of this came from. And it was really a great experience. But in that, the realization that if you're really going to augment humans a lot more effectively in harnessing the technology, it's going to require a lot of change in our organizations and our knowledge and skills about how to work and things that very, very complex. And since I'd started out trying to do something about complexity and urgency, I thought, oops, wait a minute, does that ring a bell? Well, there's a really complex problem in learning how to improve people. Oh, why don't we think about early augmentation targets for augmenting how we improve? And that's sort of like, whoa, that you get an improvement process that's structured in an effectively certain way. Then some of the things you're doing to improve your end organizations will, if deployed in your improvement process, improve the improvement process. Oh, well, why not pay a special attention to that subset of capabilities at the outset? And therefore, you're really focusing on getting an improvement infrastructure set up that you can improve the improvement. And in fact, you can improve the improvement process that's improving the improvement process. See?
Is this arrow goes to infinity or zero? I always have to ask. When we integrate, no.
Yes, when you integrate, well, it's like not only the first, but the second, even more derivative of the rate of the effectiveness of your improvement process. So I said, oh boy, that transcends any other kind of pursuit I could do. So, what is it that would do that? And that's when I thought through the kinds of augmenting collective knowledge work that is beautifully needed in all organizations, but if you set up the right kind of improvement infrastructure within and between organizations and deploy your very earliest, highest performance gains of that kind of capability, deploy it within the improvement infrastructure, zowie, you know, you take off. And that is a bigger thing than any of the particular technologies I was pursuing. So that's what the Bootstrap Institute, and I said, well, let's just try to set up an independent institute that's trying to tell the world about bootstrapping and see if somehow we can get the process to start going.
You've had a long experience with not being well received, and of course now we have awards and honorary doctorates and all kinds of things coming your way. There are people out there, many of them, who
are thinking things and seeing things that aren't particularly well received. And quite often they'll just keep their mouth shut. What do you say to people like that now that your ship has come in and you're being acknowledged?
That's funny. Well, that's funny. There's two kinds of answers come to mind. The first is sort of the kind of directing what you wanted to get out of the question. And it's hard to give advice because, you know, the history is full of people that have just sunk out of sight in the mud, waving their banner, and that never made any difference. And yet, you know, so how do you know? And the price for me, it has been really quite high for lots of years of being, well, practically an outcast. You know, people say, well, he's a nice guy, but...
That's what they said, he's a nice guy. What an indictment, Doug. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
I really don't know what to say. It's one thing is the only thing that kept me going through lots, just countless early morning being awake and tossing and saying, oh, God, this, you know, it can't be worth all this kind of ostracism or you know, stress. And yet I'd think that, you know, every year sooner that the world gets a significant increment in its capability for solving and looking at problems could make a really significant difference. If I believe that there's that kind of difference to make, there's no way I can quit. And it was like being trapped in a prison that you created yourself. See, so I said, all right, therefore that's what locked me into place. And looking back, I'd say, well, I don't know I really don't know what to say to people that keep trying. It's so that part of the answer is it's not really what you were looking for.
I'd have no idea what I was looking for. So
what kind of wise thing could you advise other younger guys who
the rest of us lost in the wilderness?
But the other part of what was triggered in my mind when you were asking that question is like saying, well, hell, I still have, there's as much of that unfinished agenda out ahead. It's the same agenda. You know, there's a huge part of it there that I'm still frustrated in trying to get people to hear, you know. And maybe that's going to start turning around in a couple of years, but there's not that much more real conviction in my mind. I used to wonder, well, what's the process that changes people's paradigms? And mostly it's experiential things that make a change, Daniel. You know, you hear the words and it doesn't do that much, but you experience it. If somebody's trying to tell you what sliding around on the slick substance called snow could do, oh, well, but you go up and you try it enough and you see people shooshing around you and you say, oh, God, I never really quite got it. And the same would be true from anything. So somehow the interactive working with computers, the potential payoff of having hypertext links and bombing around, these things like the World Wide Web and the Mosaic server or client usage of that is... terrific example that turn on in the world about that. It's just been fantastic. So anyway, that's what they're, but if there are things outside their experience, how do you get them to listen? So that's part of what the bootstrapping will do. It's an important part to get early gains in really high performance and then deploy them. And the deployment strategies where it'll do the most good, one of the factors is how will it give a good shot of experience to the kind of people that are important in getting the rest of us going? See? So there are a lot of things built into this thing I call a strategy. So,
well, Dr. Engelbart, Doug, thank you for joining me. My guest today has been Doug Engelbart, creator of many technology innovations, including the mouse. Dr. Engelbart has recently received the 1994 Price Waterhouse Lifetime Achievement Award, presented annually by the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called Drifting Continents.
On the wall in front of me is a huge map, a simulated view of our planet from space. It's the product of several years' work by a dedicated group of mappers who used weather satellite photographs to create an idealized Earth, absent of clouds, where summer rains in both the northern and southern hemispheres simultaneously. Of all the outlines to be seen in this global view, two are particularly curious: the west coast of Africa and the east coast of South America. They are, give or take a few knobs and indentations, congruent. One fits into the other, like giant jigsaw pieces. Now, allow a little movement between the two Americas, and North America fits tolerably well against Europe. If it were possible for continents to be moved around on the face of the Earth, it certainly looks as if the Americas, Africa, and Europe might once have been part of a single great continent, now fragmented into several chunks. Once, the idea of continents drifting around like pieces on a chessboard sounded pretty wild, but evidence from deep-sea cores taken in the 1950s established that the Atlantic Ocean is, in fact, widening. It's growing out of a north-south fissure in the Earth's crust known as the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Each year, North America and Europe move apart by the width of a hand, subject to a mechanism formally proposed in the early 1960s. Plate tectonics, as the driving force of continental drift is called, is now firmly established, an orthodoxy in geology classes taught today. It wasn't always so. When I studied geology at school over 30 years ago, the idea of continental drift was still heresy, a crazy notion presented by German meteorologist Alfred Wegener back in 1912. Few people took much notice of his proposal because no one could come up with a plausible mechanism to account for the movement. Yet long before Wegener formally put forward the idea, maps of the Atlantic Ocean were practically screaming out, "Continental drift!" The similarity of the shapes bounding the ocean to the east and west could hardly be missed. Take a look at a map or globe right now and decide for yourself how obvious the fit is between the coastlines of Africa and Europe with the Americas. It took less than a century after Columbus made his landfall in the New World for an Italian mapmaker, Abraham Ortelius, to notice that the shapes matched. In 1578, in a remarkably prescient passage, he wrote, "America was not sunk so much as torn away from Europe and Africa, and the vestiges of the rupture reveal themselves if someone brings forward a map of the world and considers carefully the coasts of Europe, Africa, and America, where they face each other." Not only did Ortelius notice the congruity of the coastlines, but he boldly affirmed that the continents were once joined before being severed by a rupture. 400 years later, his once ridiculed ideas are now accepted as gospel by the scientific community.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. TechNation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.